The title of the evening Dharma talk is Trying to Just Keep Quiet. I lived in India for a number of years and stayed with an Advaita teacher by the name of H.W.L. Punja. And I'd like to read a little quote from him. He said, "Any simple thing is difficult. Difficult things are not difficult. If I tell you to do something hard, like a headstand, then you could do it. But what is the difficulty in keeping quiet? It is only difficult because you have not heard it before. Keeping quiet is easy because it is your fundamental nature. You were quiet before you appeared, and you were quiet after you disappear. You were quiet before you spoke, and what you spoke ended in quietness. Everything comes from quietness and ends in quietness, and so it must stay in quietness. While speaking, you can keep quiet also." So what is difficult about just keeping quiet, being relaxed, at ease? In tonight's talk, I want to explore some of the apparent contradictions between making effort in a disciplined way and striving, and a quality of ease, of relaxation, of open acceptance. And I want to explore the role of disciplined practice in a context of realization that is neither limited to nor defined by practices. When the Buddha described his own practice before his enlightenment, he described himself as somebody who was willing to give it all, to really exert himself. And he described his approach as, "After I returned from the alms round after the meal, I sat down, folded my legs crosswise, and set the body erect, establishing mindfulness in front of me, and I resolved, I shall not break this sitting position until through not clinging my mind is liberated." Very definite. I take a seat and I will not move until my mind is free from grasping, till my mind is liberated. There are a number of discourses where the Buddha described his resolve as, "Willingly, let only my skin, sinews, and bones remain. Let the flesh and blood of my body dry up. But I will not relax my energy so long as I have not attained what can be attained by strength, energy, and effort." Imagine that. Willingly, let only my skin, sinews, and bones remain. Let the flesh and blood of my body dry up. But I will not relax my energy until I have attained what can be attained by strength, energy, and effort. There's a bit of oomph in that, a bit of strength in that. But when you come to retreats like this, very often we do not approach the practice with such a demand. And yet, can our commitment have the strength of that resolve? Is there actually a contradiction between the kind of resolve and effort that the Buddha was describing as he sat under the Bodhi tree, or as you sit underneath your individual metaphorical Bodhi trees, and the perfect surrender, the absolute idleness that the Christian mystic Meister Eckhart alludes to in his statement? He said, "Absolute stillness, absolute idleness is the best way of all. You cannot exchange this state for any other whatsoever without harming yourself." So will realization be known through our own disciplined efforts, or will it come as an experience of grace beyond effort? To do or not to do? That is the question. What must be done? How do we direct our effort? And what can our effort not affect? As you'll discover as this retreat goes on, the basic direction of our effort is to cultivate mindfulness and a quality of present moment attentiveness, awareness. We'll practice being awake and aware to the simple experiences of sitting or standing or walking. Feel the posture, be alive in the body. Experience the bodily sensations. They may be pleasant, they may be unpleasant, it doesn't matter. Can we experience them just because they are? And through that openness to our experience and the cultivation of mindfulness, the mind becomes very calm, very still, and yet also flexible. It's not stiff. Through the practice, we calm our minds and hearts so that we are not distracted nor agitated by the various things that change. Mindfulness brings a simple intention to connect and to receive the moment in all its variety, free from the distortions of preference and judgment, of reaction, so that we can abide with whatever happens to be occurring with the stillness of presence, a balanced attention that does not waver as the flow of phenomena change. The effort of mindfulness practice is not to control our experience or the phenomena. The effort is to look into the quality of our relationship with whatever is happening. How is our experience being held? How is it being known? It's like watching a river flow by, but we remain calm and still as we witness the flow of phenomena moving along. Too often in daily life, we get ahead of ourselves, lost in plans, driving one place, and actually, instead of being present with the driving, we're already planning what we're going to do at the destination or fantasizing about something else. You may have already fantasized about this retreat, even though we've just barely begun. It's very easy for the human mind to get swept up in projections and thoughts. The commitment that we make to cultivate mindfulness is to be willing to connect to our present moment experience and to connect again and to connect again and to connect again. Many, many times the mind is going to wander off into thoughts of past or future, and we simply are willing to connect again. What's actually happening now? So we use practice, we use effort to still and calm the mind, to center ourselves, so that we're not always pulled into the realm of past and future thought, of fantasy, of desire. Listen for a moment. Listen not only to the sounds, but listen to the silence. Stay attentive to that space between two sounds, the outer silence. And stay present as well for the inner silence, that space between two thoughts. Too often we listen only to the thoughts and we get caught up in the content and we miss the beauty of the silent mind, that space between two thoughts. Poonjaji, my guru, his instruction to me very often was very simple, and he would say, just keep quiet, just keep quiet. Now, he wasn't telling me to not talk so much, because I wasn't one to talk very much. He was asking for another quality of quietness. What does this mean, to just keep quiet? I think it's very important to give ourselves the opportunity to be quiet, time to let the mind settle, to set down the burdens of our projects and our busynesses and our responsibilities that we carry in our lives, to take the time to retreat, to recoup, to still the mind, and to listen. to listen to the sounds and to listen to the silence. I think it's important to spend time every day listening in meditation, in silence, and to dedicate time like this to retreat so that we observe the mind, we observe nature, we observe ourselves without the input of radio, of CDs, of TVs, of emails. The image that's often used is of muddied water. What do you have to do to purify muddied water? Very often the first step is to just stop stirring it up and the mud will settle on its own. And it's very much the same with the mind. When we come into a retreat like this, we are letting the mud settle. We are letting the mind still. And a lot of it will purify on its own through the simplicity of stillness. Meditation practice is not just for beginners. Throughout our lives, we observe and we train the mind. One of my favorite discourses of the Buddha is in the Middle Length Discourses, where the Buddha approached the chief disciple, Sariputta, and he said to Sariputta, "Sariputta, your faculties are clear. The color of your skin is pure and bright. What abiding do you often abide in now?" I just picture this scene, you know, the Buddha seeing Sariputta and saying, "You look great. What's your state of mind? What are you doing? What are you up to in your practice?" Now, of course, we assume because the Buddha was supposed to be on, you know, knows everything, that he already knew. But I just like that scene, that he was seeing a disciple who was quite radiant, and then they engaged in a conversation and a teaching regarding it. And what Sariputta said is, "I often abide in voidness." And the Buddha replied, "Good Sariputta, now indeed you often abide in the abiding of a great man, for this is the abiding of a great man, namely voidness." So Sariputta was having a very stable experience of a very pure state of mind, of emptiness, of voidness, of utter, still, and luminous clarity. And it showed through the pores of his skin, it showed through the radiance of his complexion. Now, what interested me was the Buddha gave him that praise, "This is the abiding of a great man. Good, good, Sariputta, good, good." But then he went on to give him some more instruction and some teaching. He didn't say, "Okay, now you can go rest, go take a nap, you've accomplished it." He said, "If a bhikkhu, a practitioner, should wish, 'May I often abide in voidness,' he should consider thus. On the path by which I went to the village for alms, or in the place where I wandered for alms, or on the path by which I returned from the alms round, was there any desire, lust, hate, delusion, or aversion in my mind regarding forms cognizable by the eye?" So he was asking Sariputta not just to bliss out in the state of emptiness, but to then reflect, when he walked into the village, was he entranced or reactive toward anything that he saw? And then it goes on to include anything that he heard, anything that he smelled, anything that he tasted, anything that he touched, and anything that he thought. If by so reviewing he knows there was desire, lust, hate, delusion, or aversion in my mind regarding forms cognizable by the eye, then he should make an effort to abandon those evil, unwholesome states. And if by reviewing he knows there was no desire, no lust, no hate, no delusion, and no aversion in my mind regarding forms cognizable by the eye, and then on through things I've seen, heard, smelled, tasted, touched, and thought, then he can abide happy and glad, training day and night in wholesome states. So if in that reflection, after this experience of abiding in voidness, after the experience of emptiness, one should simply reflect, on one's interaction in the world, in a mundane thing of taking a walk. If there were any unwholesome states, one should work with those. One should abandon them. And if there was nothing unwholesome in the mind, then again the Buddha didn't say, okay, you're done, now go rest, enjoy yourself. He said, abide happy and glad, training day and night in wholesome states. There's a hint of effort in this, and yet that effort is coming out of the experience of emptiness. Now, the discourse goes on because it isn't just to reflect about the absence of desire, lust, hate, delusion, and aversion in the mind. You would think if you took care of those, you'd be pretty well off. The Buddha didn't stop there. The lists go on. Then we have to consider, are the five cords of sense pleasure abandoned in me? Are the five hindrances abandoned in me? Are the five aggregates affected by clinging understood by me? Are the four foundations of mindfulness developed in me? Are the four kinds of effort developed in me? Are the five spiritual faculties developed? The five spiritual powers developed? The seven factors of enlightenment? Are you exhausted already? The Noble Eightfold Path developed in me? Are serenity and insight developed in me? Are true knowledge and deliverance realized by me? This all comes after the experience of voidness. Actually, it happens before, during, and after. But I really appreciate this sutta because even though Sariputta was so accomplished that his mind was able to attain the purity of the experience of emptiness in a very stable way, the Buddha still encouraged the continuous reflection of wholesome and unwholesome states and the continuous development of everything wholesome. And again, he said, abide happy and glad, training day and night in wholesome states. So it's a practice of repeatedly reflecting what has been done, what has been accomplished, and what must still be done. Where is the work that we still need to do? So on this retreat, we'll be taking the time to be mindful and present. We'll be looking into our own minds. You don't know what you'll find. You may suspect what you'll find if you've attended a retreat before, or if you've meditated before, even at home. But actually, we don't know what we'll find moment by moment. Sometimes we may find manifestations that none of us would want. We might find nasty thoughts, aversion, desire, judgment, condemning, resentment, desire, craving, wanting, not wanting. And we'll feel how these forces pull our minds out of balance, out of ease. Through the practice of bringing mindfulness to meet our experience, even to meet desire, aversion, wanting, not wanting, resentment, fear, jealousy, happiness, delight, joy, tranquility, everything, we meet these experiences with mindfulness, and through the continuity of that mindfulness, the mind becomes steady and the heart becomes strong. We become very stable and undistracted so that we remain open to whatever occurs in a moment, in a day, in a life, without being thrown off balance by it, without being distracted by it. We can find some space around these forces of reactivity or of suffering. These forces of desire and aversion, wanting one thing and not another, are fairly gross dynamics of mind. And we'll work with these with mindfulness. Yet there'll also be many times when you'll look into your mind and you'll honestly say there is no desire or aversion present. Unwholesome states are not present right now. The mind may be calm, tranquil. There may be delight and joy in the mind, equanimity, peace. And yet, we may not yet be completely free. So then we look. When the mind is clear, when the mind is calm, is there still a dynamic of subtle suffering, a dualistic formation, even if it's not as gross as a desire and aversion, wanting and not wanting? Our initial relationship to perception can very often be based on a subtle quality of clinging. The mind may habitually move out to experience and relate to our objects in a way that grasps a hold of them, even to be mindful of them. And we may have a kind of over-striving in our meditation practice, so that instead of just being aware of our experience and mindful of it with a balanced mind, we're moving into it. But actually, mindfulness doesn't have the force that intrudes upon what we're perceiving. Mindfulness is likened to having a flashlight or a torch. We shine the light on the phenomena, on the experience, whatever we're seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, or thinking, so that it's illuminated. But light doesn't have the force to dent the experience, to change it, to alter it. Sometimes the very techniques that we use of mindfulness that are so useful for abandoning and reducing desire and aversion eventually become an obstacle. The great Indian saint Ramana Maharshi was very fond of using an example of thorns. And those of you who've been to Tiruvannamalai in South India will know exactly why this was such an easy example for him, because he lived on this mountain called Arunachala, and it is just covered with these thorny bush that has thorns that are quite long. And so he often used this example where he said, if you're walking along and you get stabbed by a thorn and you have a thorn embedded in your skin, the way you take it out is you pluck another thorn from the bush and you use the second thorn to dig out or to pry out or to poke out that first thorn. The second thorn is considered our practices, our meditative techniques, our spiritual practices, our disciplines. So the question becomes, what do we do with these thorns? Some people hear that our practice is a thorn, and so we should throw our practice away. That no practice, complete effortlessness, is higher, is better. Unfortunately, sometimes the mind isn't quiet. And although we may not create an identification as being the meditator, we may still be practicing desire, hatred, judgment, confusion, ignorance. We may still be attached to views and opinions. We may still be involved in obsessive thinking, how superior the practice is of not making effort, because we've thrown the thorn away. And I think this approach is a bit imbalanced. And it's sad, because if we have not actually purified the mind of the subtle forms of suffering, of doer and doing, of the dualistic attachments to subject and object, but we've abandoned the tool through which we can extract it, then it's very easy to slide into despair, into confusion, and we won't know where we'll find a refuge. So the thorn example is a wonderful one, because we use the thorn for a purpose. We don't throw it away until we've extracted the first thorn. But on the other hand, there is a subtle initial dynamic of ignorance that arises whenever we initiate a doer, whenever we become the one who is doing something. We become the meditator. We become the seer. We become the thinker. The concept of one who can do something, that sense of subjecthood, of I am, of me, of authorship, of self-referencing, is a form of delusion. Depending on how we practice mindfulness, depending on the appropriateness of our effort and the skillfulness of our relationship to the practices, we can either use mindfulness to free the mind from greed, from hatred, from delusion, or mindfulness could strengthen the experience of being a meditator, of being a spiritual person, of being mindful. In fact, we might get so enraptured by mindfulness and get so good at meditation that we might have the illusion that we can control our perceptions, that we can control our experience. And then we are doing a lot more than we need to do. The very arising of the doer, the thinker, the knower is illusion. And one of the challenges with any meditative practice is the simple exertion to meditate, the effort to be aware, without becoming the meditator or the one who is aware. Not using the techniques of meditation to create a place for identification to land. Meditation is extremely important to reduce the heavy burden of a mind that is fascinated by its own preferences and its own reactions. We use the mindfulness practice to free the mind from negativity and from craving. And meditation is also a primary way to cultivate a balanced and clear perception, to abandon all unwholesome states, and to clarify and purify the mind. There really is a lot that we can do. And I've probably met more practitioners who are hindered by the lack of effort than by excessive effort. Too often we are limited by our own laziness or our not quite giving 100%, not quite giving our all. Too often we hold back from our full potential, from our full commitment, from the real possibility of awakening in this very life, perhaps in this very retreat, maybe even in this moment. This is possible to awaken now. This awakening may not be something that we can do. And yet, when we come together in a meditation retreat, we do something. But as we do our practice, we simultaneously investigate the doing, the process and the dangers of doing itself. Can there be doing without a doer? Which occurs first, the self or the action, the subject or the object? Ignorance initially arises with this position of self, self-reference, the doer. And so doing can seem to philosophically be doomed to remain always in the realm of suffering. Yet without doing, most people simply slip back into the same old patterns that have troubled us for years. The same old patterns, the same conditioned ways that we know haven't worked. So the illustration of the thorn is important. We use the thorn. We don't throw it away too soon. We toss it aside when the work has been done, when our freedom is known, not as an ideal of effortlessness, nor as a preferred way of approaching the spiritual journey. More simply, we respond with integrity to the present moment. Is there something that can be done right now in the way we're experiencing this moment to free the mind from grasping, to release preference, to release suffering, to cease the struggle with experience? What would a wise engagement with the present moment be just now? The teachings of liberation are tremendously radical, but I don't believe that the instruction to just keep quiet, do nothing, don't think, is any more radical than to abide glad and happy practicing day and night. Ramana Maharshi, the great Indian saint and non-dual master, said, effort is needed to stabilize realization. In freedom, there is no conflict between the approaches of effort and ease, of discipline and relaxation. And once released, history tells us that the great sages still meditated. They kept quiet. Or they lived very simple lives. If you look at the lives of people like in India, Ramakrishna or Buddha or Ramana Maharshi, what you'll find is not the image of somebody kicked back, lazy, enjoying their spiritual retirement. Quite the opposite, in fact. You'll find people who served day and night, who sat in silence, who lived simple, austere lives. When I lived with Punjaji, now he was somebody who had a reputation for not encouraging any formal practice, any repetitive practice. And so people would come and visit him and stay a few days, a few weeks, and leave saying, Punjaji recommends no practice. He says, don't meditate. But I lived in his home for more than 3 years. I saw him day and night. He may have said not to practice meditation, but he still sat with his legs crossed and his eyes closed for between 4 and 6 hours a day. That's the kind of not practicing to do. Not make anything of it, and yet still do it. The years of living with Punjaji were the most disciplined and renunciate, austere years of my life. The monasteries in Thailand were luxury in comparison. And yet, Punjaji had this reputation for being a lay teacher who taught no practice. One time, a friend of mine who had had a profound experience with Punjaji, very deep insight, asked him, what about meditation after realization? What about practicing after deep insight? And Punjaji's response wasn't to say, you don't need it anymore. He said, what else could you want to do? That's the love of practice. That's when practice and awakening are completely undifferentiated. No division. The Buddha told Sariputta to repeatedly reflect and to practice day and night. Punjaji told me to meditate constantly. He never told me not to meditate. Never once, not in all those years. He told me to meditate constantly. Any effort that is based on a self-centered mind of I am meditating, I am the meditator, cannot be constant. It cannot be waking and sleeping day and night. Because if we give rise to the doer, I will be there to get tired. everything conditioned is impermanent. And so if we engage in practice from that dualistic perspective, we will get tired. But practice beyond the conditioned mind, natural meditation, natural awareness, an attunement with the unconditioned, an alignment with the truth of things, a dropping into and opening up to the truth of things, that is continuously available, day and night. As we explore the spectrum of effort and ease in our practice, sense perhaps this quality of awareness, of effort, that occurs day and night, that doesn't have to keep being prodded and prompted into existence. Sometimes we have to really force ourselves. We have to bring in a quality of effort. We have to almost pull ourselves up with that energetic quality. And other times we don't need to do that at all. We rest into the experience as it is, and there is no effort because there is no grasping. This is a quality of commitment that is utterly infused with ease. A depth of commitment that goes beyond our personal interests. The ease is not found through abandoning effort, but by purifying the effort of the arrogance and striving of self-interest, purifying the effort of the identification with being the one who is doing it, the one who can accomplish something, the one who might get a little fame, or get a little prestige, or have an enlightenment experience. The one who might attain something personal. The meditative path is not about attainment. It's about release, about relinquishment, about letting go. Not grasping. Not grasping day and not grasping night. Not grasping the doer. Not grasping what we're doing, the task. And not grasping the result of what we're doing, not grasping the time that it takes to do it, and not clinging to any comparison of any sort. This way, effort occurs spontaneously, and it is always available, always present, without beginning and without end. Dharma practice responds to both relative truth and ultimate truth. We don't throw one out by disregarding the other as being too tense or too uncertain or too unknown. Consider for yourself, is there really a contradiction between discipline and grace? Ramana Maharshi said, there is a state beyond both effort and effortlessness. Yet until it is realized, effort is necessary. So much can be done in the realm of effort. Yet something beyond effort, beyond discipline may be required. A knowing that cannot be contained, predicted, or controlled. A dedication and a longing so complete that fascination with the senses has ended. The Indian mystic poet Kabir said, it is the intensity of the longing that does all the work. Sense for yourself your desire to be free, the desire to go beyond suffering, the desire to find peace, to know the depth of love, not just the limited love of caring about someone or something, but an ultimate experience of boundless, dimensionless love. What then could be singled out as a particular practice, or just becomes the natural way of knowing, knowing things as they unfold, as they come, as they go? Ajahn Chah, the Tibetan forest master, put it very simply. He said, Within itself, the mind is timeless, naturally peaceful, unmoving. Rest in the natural state. If the changing sense impressions cause the mind to forget itself, to be deceived and entangled, your practice is to see this whole process and simply return to original mind. Let's have a few minutes of silence together, please.